if you pull up a map of the world, it is, you know, overwhelmingly intensely blue.
Right, it's mostly water.
Yeah, exactly. But it's really easy to forget that for the vast majority of human history, that blue is basically just a flat, opaque boundary. I mean, you could sail across the top of it.
Sure, or drop a net and pull some fish out.
Right. But beneath that surface, it was a locked vault, just this entirely inaccessible, completely alien environment that just happens to cover most of our own planet.
And the thing keeping that vault locked wasn't a lack of curiosity or anything. It was really just the physical limitations of human biology.
Because we're land animals.
Exactly. We are fundamentally terrestrial creatures. The moment we slip beneath the surface, our eyes can't focus, the cold just immediately saps our body heat, and, well, most critically, we just can't breathe down there.
But today is actually June 11th, which means it is a very happy birthday to the man who essentially forged the key to that vault.
Jacques-Yves Cousteau.
Yep, born in France on this exact day over a century ago, back in 1910. And for today's deep dive, we've gathered a really diverse stack of sources for you. We're looking at everything from like historical diving timelines and these translated Russian scientific biographies, all the way to modern environmental project pitches, and honestly, even some pretty heated social media comment sections.
It's a really wide range of perspectives.
It is, because our mission today is to explore how a truly bizarre string of personal accidents, and honestly, just a stubborn desire to see clearly underwater, completely transformed humanity's relationship with the ocean. I mean, we're tracing the journey from humans desperately holding their breath to scientists literally living inside pressurized underwater habitats.
What's fascinating here is that the irony of Cousteau's life is that he was not, bred for the ocean.
Right, he wasn't a marine biologist or anything.
Not at all. He didn't grow up studying oceanography. He had no special scientific degrees initially. He was really just a tinkerer, a mechanic at heart. And his path to the water was incredibly reluctant, driven mostly by a need to heal his own broken body.
Okay, let's unpack this because it
Yeah.
really does read like one of those superhero origin stories,
Okay, yeah.
you know, where destiny is disguised as a total disaster.
It really does. When you look into his early life, he was a very, very frail kid.
Yeah, the biographies say at age 7, he was diagnosed with chronic enteritis.
Right, which is this severe intestinal inflammation.
Exactly. And it left him constantly sickly, extremely thin. He basically couldn't participate in a lot of the rough and tumble stuff that all the other kids were doing.
So he ends up turning his energy inward. He became completely obsessed with how things worked. I mean, by the time he was 13, he had built a fully functioning, battery-powered model of a car.
Wait, a working car at 13?
Yeah, a model, but fully functional.
Hmm.
And he was always taking cameras apart, modifying them to film his surroundings. That mechanical intuition really became the defining trait of his entire career.
But even with all that, he still wasn't looking at the ocean, right? I mean,
Oh.
even when he joins the Naval Academy at age 20, his eyes are completely on the sky.
He wanted to be a pilot.
Right. He was deep into aviation training. And then his 20s take this absolutely brutal turn. He gets into a horrific car crash that nearly kills him.
It was incredibly severe. Both of his arms were broken.
Shattered, basically. The damage is so extensive that his dreams of flying are just instantly, permanently over.
The doctors actually considered amputating one of his arms at one point.
Wow.
Yeah. And to rehabilitate his shattered muscles, they prescribed this rigorous physical therapy routine, which was that he had to swim in the Mediterranean Sea every single day.
But there was a catch, right? Because the salt water was just burning his eyes to the point where he almost couldn't stand it.
The Mediterranean is incredibly salty.
Yeah. And I feel like most people would just, you know, swim with their eyes shut or maybe go ask the doctor for a totally different exercise. But because Cousteau is this inveterate tinkerer, he refuses to just accept that biological limit.
He literally goes back to his workshop.
He does. He cobbles together a pair of specialized goggles from some glass and old inner tubes just so he can do his rehab without the pain.
And that conviction, which was born out of pure frustration, really changes everything because underwater vision is actually a physics problem.
Right, because water bends light differently.
Exactly. Water refracts light differently than air does. Our corneas rely on the optical density of air to focus light onto our retinas. So when water touches the eye directly, that focusing ability just vanishes. That's why everything looks super blurry when you open your eyes underwater.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
Yeah. So by trapping a pocket of air in front of his eyes with those makeshift goggles, Cousteau basically restored his cornea's ability to focus.
So he puts those goggles on, he plunges his face into the Mediterranean, and suddenly this blurry, stinging void just snaps into crystal clear focus.
For the first time.
Yeah. He sees the fish, the rocks, the kelp forests. But the second he solves the vision problem, he immediately hits the biological limit again, the breathing problem.
Right.
He can finally see this mesmerizing world, but he has to constantly race right back up to the surface for air.
And that personal frustration connects him to a technological puzzle that humanity had been failing to solve for over 2,000 years.
Let's actually talk about that puzzle, because people have been trying to cheat their way underwater for a very long time. In the historical timelines we pulled, there's this famous account of a Greek diver named Silas. This is around 500 BC.
Oh, the Persian ship story.
Yes. He was supposedly taken prisoner on a Persian ship, managed to jump overboard, and used a hollow reed as a breathing tube to hide underwater while he cut the Persian anchor lines.
It's a great story, but from a scientific perspective, it highlights a massive physiological hurdle. If Silas was using a reed, he was barely below the surface.
Right.
Because you cannot just use a longer reed to go deeper.
Yeah, because of the water pressure compressing your chest. I have to admit, I never fully understood this until reading up on the physics of diving for this deep dive. When you take a breath on land, your diaphragm muscle pulls downward to expand your lungs, right?
Correct. Which creates a vacuum that pulls air in.
Right. But water is incredibly heavy.
It's staggeringly heavy. For every 10 meters you descend, the pressure increases by a full atmosphere. But honestly, even just 50 centimeters below the surface, so about a foot and a half, the weight of the water pushing against your chest cavity is so intense that your diaphragm simply isn't strong enough to expand your lungs against it.
Wait, really? Just a foot and a half?
Just a foot and a half. You could have a totally clear tube leading right up to the fresh air.
Yeah.
And your body physically wouldn't be able to pull that air down.
Wow. So since we can't pull air down from the surface, humanity tries to bring the air down with them. You get those diving bells in the 16th century, which are basically just giant, heavy buckets lowered upside down into the water to trap a pocket of air.
Yeah. A free diver swims out, does a minute of work, swims back up into the bucket to gasp a breath, and goes back out.
Which is terrifying. And that eventually evolves into those massive, heavy brass diving helmets.
Right, but those rely on people up at the surface manually pumping pressurized air down a long hose to literally force it into the diver's lungs.
But a hose is basically a louche. I mean, you aren't swimming. You're just stomping around in the mud and heavy lead boots. But wait, here's the thing that completely blew my mind looking into these historical timelines.
Oh, the aerophore.
Yes. Someone actually solved the free swimming problem long before Cousteau. In 1865, two Frenchmen, a mining engineer named Rouquayrol and a naval officer named Dinarus, they patented a device called the aerophore. Jules Verne even wrote about it in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
The aerophore was actually an incredible piece of engineering for its time. It was the first on-demand breathing apparatus.
How did it work?
It featured this flexible membrane exposed to the surrounding water. As the diver went deeper, the water pressure pushed harder on that membrane, which in turn pushed a valve that increased the air pressure being delivered to the diver. It automatically matched the internal air pressure to the external water pressure.
Okay, wait. So they had the aerophore in 1865, and Jules Verne is writing about it, but humanity just somehow forgot about it until Cousteau and Gagnon came along almost 80 years later. Were they just, like, terrible at marketing?
Well, no, it was really a limitation of material science at the time. To be truly independent, you know, a free-swimming diver, you need to carry your air with you.
Right.
But back in 1865, they just didn't have the metallurgy to create high-pressure steel cylinders. The low-pressure tanks they did have could only hold a few minutes of air.
Oh, I see.
So divers still had to be connected to a surface pump via a hose for any kind of prolonged work, which basically reduced the aerophore to just a slightly more comfortable tether.
Okay, so fast forward to the 1930s. High-pressure tanks finally exist. Divers like Yves Laprire are literally strapping them to their backs. But he didn't have that automatic demand valve, right?
No, he didn't.
He literally had a continuous flow of air just blasting into his face mask. He had to manually turn a valve by hand every time he wanted a breath and then shut it off when he exhaled.
Which wasted an enormous amount of compressed air in just a matter of minutes.
So this is where Cousteau's frustration meets perfect timing. By 1942, right in the middle of World War II, Cousteau teams up with an engineer named Émile Gagnon.
And Gagnon worked for a Parisian gas company. He had been designing demand valves for car engines running on cooking gas because, you know, there were severe wartime fuel shortages.
And Cousteau realizes that a car engine needing a specific mix of gas isn't all that different from a human lung needing air under pressure. So they start modifying Gagnon's valve for diving. But there is a massive physical hurdle they have to clear regarding the placement of the valves, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Because hydrostatic pressure is incredibly hypersensitive. Cousteau and Gagnon discovered that if the exhaust valve, you know, where the bubbles come out, was physically higher on the diver's body than the intake valve, the slight decrease in water pressure at that higher elevation would cause the air to just free flow uncontrollably out of the tank.
Oh, wow.
But if the exhaust was lower, the diver had to suck incredibly hard to overcome the water pressure just to get a single breath.
So how do you fix it when a diver is, you know, constantly swimming in totally different positions?
You place the intake and exhaust valves right next to each other.
Yeah.
Exactly at the same level behind the diver's head.
Oh, that's brilliant.
By neutralizing that pressure differential across the chest, the valve only delivered air precisely when the diver inhaled and easily vented the exhaust when they exhaled, completely independent of their orientation in the water.
And just like that, the Aqualung is born. And I mean, let's just acknowledge the sheer audacity of this timeline. Cousteau is secretly testing this revolutionary device in the Marne River outside Paris in 1943.
Right under the nose of the German occupation.
Yes, right around the time he's reportedly conducting espionage for the French resistance. I mean, he's literally inventing the future of oceanography in the middle of a global war.
And they moved incredibly quickly. By the end of 1943, Cousteau and his close diving partners, Frédéric Dumas and Philippe Tellez, had logged over 500 dives in the sea. They had finally severed the tether.
They were basically flying weightless through the water. But the ocean is relentless. The deeper they went, the more they realized the human body still had these really hard limits. There's this intense story in the sources where Dumas decides to see how deep they can push the Aqualung. He descends to 70 meters, which is nearly 230 feet, and suddenly experiences what they came to call depth narcosis.
Yeah, Cousteau called it l'ivresse des grandes profondeurs, the rapture of the deep. Under extreme pressure, the physics of the gases we breathe change fundamentally.
How so?
Well, at sea level, the nitrogen that makes up 78% of our air is entirely inert. Our bodies basically just ignore it.
Yep.
But under the immense pressure of 70 meters of water, that nitrogen actually dissolves into the fatty tissues of our nervous system.
And that actually changes how the brain fires, right?
Right, exactly. It completely interferes with the electrical signals between neurons. The effect is almost indistinguishable from severe alcohol intoxication.
It sounds terrifying.
It is. Divers feel euphoric, reckless, they completely lose their judgment, and eventually they lose consciousness. Dumas barely made it back to the surface on that dive. It was a very harsh reminder that having the key to the vault didn't mean they were immune to the traps inside.
Absolutely. By the way, impartial note here, there is a fascinating debate in the diving community regarding the terminology of all this. A lot of people on social media use the words aqualung and scuba interchangeably.
Right, they do.
But the sources clarify that the aqualung was the specific patented device Cousteau and Gagnon invented. SCUBA is actually an acronym coined later by the U.S. military for self-contained underwater breathing apparatus.
It's a very good distinction to make. But, you know, whatever you call it, the invention meant humans were no longer just visitors peering into the ocean. They could actually be residents.
Yeah.
But to map this new frontier, Cousteau needed a mobile headquarters.
Enter the Calypso. I think it's really easy to picture this gleaming, high-tech science vessel, but its origins were wildly gritty.
Oh, completely.
The Calypso was originally built in 1942 as a British Royal Navy minesweeper. It served in World War II, then got sold off and spent years operating as a literal ferry, just shuttling cars and tourists back and forth between Malta and Gozo.
It was essentially a wooden-hulled workhorse.
Mm.
But Cousteau secured the funding to buy it and basically gutted the entire thing. He transformed this rusty ferry into an unprecedented floating laboratory.
And here's where it gets really interesting. Because it wasn't just a lab. It was this floating, almost bohemian compound of science. It's almost like the Starship Enterprise.
That's a good comparison.
Right. You have this self-contained, exploring family traversing alien worlds with this charismatic captain. Cousteau moved his wife onto the ship, and their two young sons were officially registered as cabin boys.
Yeah, you have 22 divers and scientists all crammed together.
Eating fish stew in the mess hall, analyzing maps, they even built a wine cellar into the hull.
Of course they did. And that intense camaraderie and the romance of that exploration translated perfectly to the public.
Yeah.
In 1956, Cousteau teamed up with a young filmmaker named Louis Malle to release The Silent World.
Which was a total paradigm shift. I mean, before that film, the public imagined the deep ocean as this dark, terrifying abyss just full of monsters.
Right.
But The Silent World showed them coral reefs exploding with color, schools of fish moving like synchronized dancers. It won the Palme d'Or at Cannes and an Academy Award. It made the Calypso so iconic that John Denver literally wrote a massive pop song about it that hit number 2 on the charts.
But Cousteau was already looking past the ship. He didn't just want to dive down and come back. He wanted to live on the bottom. In the early 1960s, he launched the Conshelf Project Continental Shelf Station.
Right.
Conshelf the first, F3rd, and the third were actual pressurized habitats placed on the ocean floor.
This is where we get into saturation diving, which is just such a wild biological workaround. If you dive deep, your blood absorbs nitrogen. If you come up too fast, that nitrogen bubbles in your veins, causing decompression sickness or the bends, which can be fatal.
Yes, it's incredibly dangerous.
So you have to ascend agonizingly slowly.
Right. If you dive for an hour, you might have to spend hours decompressing. It makes deep work incredibly inefficient.
Mm.
But Cousteau capitalized on a fascinating physiological fact. Your body can only absorb so much nitrogen.
Okay.
After about 24 hours under pressure, your tissues are fully saturated. At that point, your decompression time is locked. It'll take the exact same amount of time to decompress whether you stay down for one more day or one more month.
Wow. So his solution was basically just don't come up. Live down there at the ambient water pressure. During Conshelf III in 1965, 6 aquanauts lived inside a spherical habitat at 100 meters down for 22 solid days. They ran out to the water to work and came back inside to sleep, eat, and breathe.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, this is the critical turning point in Cousteau's life. Because when you spend weeks at a time living on the ocean floor, year after year, your relationship to the environment fundamentally changes. You begin to notice the slow, creeping degradation that a casual observer would just totally miss.
The explorer becomes protector.
Exactly.
Cousteau starts noticing the physical scars left by industrial trawler fishing, dragging heavy nets across the reefs. He sees the toxic spread of oil pollution long before the broader public was really talking about it. He essentially uses his massive global celebrity to sound the alarm. He summed up his philosophy with a phrase that still drives conservation today. People protect what they love what they understand, and they understand what they are taught.
It's a very powerful philosophy.
Okay.
But it also forces us to reckon with the messy reality of historical pioneers.
Yeah.
When you look at his entire timeline, and public discussions today certainly do, you find some pretty striking contradictions.
Oh, absolutely. The deeper you dig into his history, the more complex it gets. For instance, the official record celebrates him as this decorated hero who used his diving operations as cover for French resistance espionage during WWII.
Right.
But then you look at certain modern historical debates in the sources, and there are intense allegations asserting the exact opposite, that he was actually collaborating with the occupying Nazi forces to secure funding and resources for his research.
And you see a similar paradox in his environmental record, too.
Yeah.
He is undeniably a father of modern marine conservation. Yet, if you watch The Silent World today, some of the scenes are incredibly difficult to stomach. There are moments of sheer cruelty dynamiting coral reefs just to count the dead fish, or the crew brutally massacring a group of sharks simply because they were eating a whale calf the ship had accidentally hit.
And, I mean, finding those details completely jarring is natural. It really challenges the pristine image we have of him. How do we even reconcile the guy who taught the world to love the ocean with the guy who's blowing up reefs for the camera?
It requires understanding that early exploration was almost universally extractive and rough. In the mid-20th century, nature was largely viewed as an endless resource to be conquered, or, you know, staged for drama. The painful irony is that it was precisely this initial invasive intrusion, the dynamiting, the harvesting, that provided the baseline data to prove that the ocean was actually incredibly fragile. The pioneer's destructive footprint is often what alerts them to the fact that the landscape can be broken in the first place.
That makes a lot of sense. He basically had to cross the line to realize the line was there.
Mm-hmm.
Which brings us to the modern ripple effect of his life. So what does this all mean for you and me? Why does this tinkerer from 1943 matter to the science happening right now?
Well, the tools he built are currently unearthing secrets that are vital to human survival.
Yeah, and you see that legacy continuing directly through his family. His grandson, Fabien Cousteau, is currently spearheading the Proteus Project. It's pitched as this advanced, modular, underwater research station designed to be the marine equivalent of the International Space Station.
allowing scientists to live and work at depth for really extended periods.
Exactly. And the research they are conducting in these extreme environments isn't just about cataloging new species of crabs. It has profound medical applications. I was reading in the sources about how marine biologists are studying deep sea organisms to develop new pharmaceuticals.
Which makes perfect evolutionary sense, really.
How so?
Well, the ocean is a hyper-competitive chemical battlefield. Marine organisms like deep sea sponges and seabed algae have been fighting off marine viruses and bacteria for hundreds of millions of years. They have evolved these highly complex defensive proteins and compounds that simply do not exist in terrestrial plants.
And the applications for that are stunning. Researchers recently isolated a specific protein derived from ocean seabed algae growing near coral reefs. In lab tests, this marine protein has shown significant activity in neutralizing MERS Middle East Respiratory Syndrome.
Because the protein is able to bind to the unique viral structures, effectively blocking the virus from entering and replicating inside human cells.
That is wild.
It is. And since MERS is a highly lethal coronavirus, very closely related to the virus that causes COVID-19, analyzing these deep sea compounds could actually be the key to designing therapeutics for the next global pandemic.
So we've literally gone from Cousteau testing a valve in a French river to modern scientists using the depths of the ocean to fight global respiratory viruses.
That's an amazing leap.
But beyond the hard science, Cousteau's legacy of media-savvy activism, you know, leveraging cameras and celebrity to make the public care, is the exact blueprint used by modern organizations like Greenpeace today.
Completely. Greenpeace operates its own legendary fleet, including the ship, the Arctic Sunrise. And when they recently campaigned to create an enormous Antarctic Ocean sanctuary to protect the waters from industrial fishing, they didn't just send scientists.
Right.
They brought along modern celebrities like actor David Harbour from Stranger Things to amplify the message on social media and bring the frozen ocean into millions of living rooms.
It is the exact same playbook Cousteau wrote when he put cameras on the Calypso. Show them the beauty so they will fall in love with it, so they will demand it be protected.
When you look back at the entire arc of his life, it is staggering.
Yeah.
I mean, in a single lifetime, we went from a frail boy whose eyes burned in the salt water to a global icon who literally handed humanity the mechanical lungs to survive underwater. He showed us the vibrant, fragile reality of the deep sea and ultimately forced us to realize that our own survival is entirely dependent on the health of this water planet.
It really is an unbelievable trajectory. We finally picked the lock to that blue vault, but I want to leave you, the listener, with one final thought today regarding what we are doing with that open door.
Yeah.
Cousteau believed we would protect what we learned to love. But today, the vast majority of our deep oceans remain entirely unexplored. We literally have better maps of the surface of Mars than we do of our own seafloor.
That's true.
Yet at the exact same time, rapid advances in deep sea mining technology are allowing massive industries to carve up and exploit those abyssal plains before scientists even have a chance to fully understand the ecosystems down there. So the question we have to ask ourselves now is, in the race to conquer the deep, are we discovering the ocean's secrets fast enough to fall in love with them before they disappear entirely?